You're listening to The Star Spot, episode 144, for Sunday, April 1st, 2018.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at The Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast.
You can now find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot or follow us on Twitter at @thestarspot.
The gravity, radiation, and tidal forces at the very core of the Milky Way is kind of intense. That's why astronomers have long doubted the possibility of star formation in such a hostile environment. And then everything changed with the discovery last fall of 11 sun-like stars living closer to the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy than the distance between our sun and its closest neighbor. What does this breakthrough mean for our understanding of star formation and the possibility of life in what we once imagined were impossibly extreme environments? Today we're joined here at the Star Spot by the discovery team's leader, Farhad Youssef Zadeh.
But first, here's what's current in space.
The Star Spot podcast is now the Star Spot podcast and radio show. That's right, your favorite astronomy program is now traveling through space, specifically the 1280 AM frequency. Our broadcaster, CJRU The Scope at Ryerson, is now available on the radio dial, which means you can join us at the Star Spot at 1280 AM every Sunday 8 PM and Tuesday 6 PM Eastern Time.
The world of science has seen many defining figures, like Albert Einstein and Isaac Newton. But we've gotten to know another particularly well, Stephen Hawking, who, on March 14, 2018, passed away at the age of 76. To say that his loss will be felt is a true understatement, for he inspired not only a new generation of scientists and science enthusiasts, but people from all walks of life, despite being physically disabled. This is indeed evidence of a life well lived and worth a reflection. In 1963, when Hawking was just 21 years old and studying cosmology at the University of Cambridge in England, he received a grim diagnosis: amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, a devastating neurodegenerative disease. He was given 2 years to live. Yet incredibly, he defied his doctor's prognosis by decades, enabling him to continue his studies, which resulted in two major breakthroughs in physics, even as his ALS progressed to the point when he could no longer move, resulting in confinement to a wheelchair, followed by his loss of speech, which was replaced with a voice synthesizer. His two theories changed the way we view the universe. In 1966, Hawking published his doctoral thesis, which postulated that the universe had a beginning, a singularity in which all of space and time was condensed and then burst forth, with quantum effects instigating the creation of everything we see around us: galaxies, stars, planets, and life. This idea meant that Einstein's theory of general relativity and quantum mechanics must be linked, forming the basis for what we know today as the Big Bang. But if the universe had a beginning, Hawking proposed, then it must also have an end, in the form of black holes. In the 1970s, he suggested that black holes don't pull in everything that gets too close, but that they can actually emit particles, resulting in their eventual disappearance. Hawking theorized that this phenomenon began shortly after the Big Bang, when minuscule black holes the size of protons burst into existence, operating under relativity and quantum mechanics. It was coined Hawking radiation in his honor. While his work in physics continued well into his later years, in 1988, Hawking began his career in science communication when he published his first book, A Brief History of Time, in which he explains, using layman's terms and wit, the lifetime of the universe. It was an instant hit, becoming an international bestseller. He went on to write more books and hosted multiple television documentaries on science and cosmology, offering his stirring thoughts on ideas like parallel universes, time travel, artificial intelligence, and extraterrestrial life, including his passionate conviction that humanity's future lies in space. On top of it all, his wry sense of humor made him a bona fide celebrity, appearing memorably in beloved television series like The Simpsons, Futurama, The Big Bang Theory, and Star Trek: The Next Generation. Although Hawking broke new ground in science and encouraged us all to look up, he also leaves behind a deeper legacy, that in overcoming adversity. He proved that if you're in an apparently hopeless situation, you can still find meaning out of it. What's crucial is that you not be self-pitiful, but rather think about what you can do next and strive to make that a reality. It's a message for all humanity to remember. Thank you, Stephen.
And that's What's Current in Space.
Farhad Yousef Zadeh received his undergraduate degree from the State University of New York at Stony Brook, then performed his PhD work at Columbia University. He worked as a National Research Council postdoctoral fellow at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center before joining the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Northwestern University. He enjoys performing public lectures on the history of astronomy, science and pseudoscience, and how science affects our lives.
I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today here at the Star Spot by Professor Farhad Yousef Zadeh. Thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to be talking about a recent discovery was done by a team that you led, and that's a discovery of stars that you found very close to the black hole, the so-called Sagittarius A star black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. But sort of to set that up, I want to ask you first about the center of the Milky Way galaxy, because there are some extreme conditions, shall we say, at the center, which made the discovery of these stars so close to that supermassive black hole kind of unpredicted. So can you tell me what are those conditions like that made it so unlikely, at least the perception was that it was unlikely that we would find stars so close in?
Yeah, one of the issues that we have to deal with is the tidal force by the black hole. As you know, there is a supermassive black hole at the center of our own galaxy, and it has a mass of 4 million times the mass of the sun. And when you have a very strong gravity from the black hole, the gravitational force, or sometimes called the tidal force, is very strong. So in an object, if you have an object approaching the black hole, tidal effects will try to rip it apart in the radial direction as it sort of comes in closer in. So if you have a spherical object, let's say if a cloud, let's say, approaching the black hole, it gets stretched in the radial direction as it moves closer to the black hole, and also gets squeezed in the direction perpendicular to the radial direction, to the direction of the motion. And that is the cloud gets really tortured by this the strong tidal effects, and it's very hard for a cloud to collapse under its own gravity and form stars because of the stretching that is happening by the tidal effect of the black hole itself. And that's really one of the strongest effect that prevents the collapse of a cloud as the cloud approaches the black hole. There are other effects as well. The radiation from lots of massive stars in the vicinity of the black hole also can evaporate the gas cloud. They can make it a little bit difficult for a cloud to survive if the radiation is very strong. And these are really the two effects, but it's much, much, the tidal effect is much, much more important in preventing star formation near a supermassive black hole.
So we have these extreme conditions at the center of the galaxy, which made us believe that the formation of any stars would be difficult. But I think, if I understand correctly, in particular, low-mass stars or sun-like stars, we thought would be virtually impossible so close to the black hole. Can you just explain why sun-like stars or low-mass stars were seen to be, even more challenging as a potential creation happening so close into the center?
Well, massive stars are generally much, you would think that the masses are large enough that can somehow survive the tidal effects. And we've had we know that there are lots of massive stars forming near the black hole. This is the way that star formation takes place. Forming these massive stars is done in a very unusual way. These massive stars, we have about 100 massive stars that are orbiting around the black hole, very close to the black hole. And these stars were formed a few million years ago. And they're young, and they're massive stars. And the idea was that you can only form massive stars very close to the black hole because, again, the tidal effects are going to be much tougher on low-mass stars. But I think that's not the case. We haven't really studied theoretically what is the nature of the star formation with different masses. But it turns out that low-mass stars, theoretically, can actually survive better than more massive stars. This is a rather new result that shows that this is the case. So that's on the theoretical side of things. But observationally, we cannot really detect low-mass stars at 25,000 light years away from us. So that has been a difficulty. We see massive stars forming, and we've detected them because they're fairly bright. But low-mass stars are too faint, and we have lots of extinction between us and the center of the galaxy, and they're generally faint in terms of their emission. So this was a surprise on the observational side to detect low-mass stars, but also we now, I think, have a better theoretical understanding that low-mass stars may actually be dominant in this part of the galaxy, because up until now, people have also considered that high-mass stars can survive only near the supermassive black hole. So in other words, the distribution of stars are tilted more towards more massive stars than towards low-mass stars. So, but it turns out that theoretical studies that have been done indicate that you can, in fact, form low-mass stars, and the distribution doesn't necessarily need to be heavy towards high-mass stars. And you can have, actually, looks like you can have more low-mass stars surviving very close to the black hole than high-mass stars.
Well, that's a really great setup, because now we're going to talk about the discovery of just such a set of low-mass stars that your team discovered very, very close in to the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. So can you tell me a little bit about that discovery? How was that made, and what did you find, and where did you find it?
Right. As I mentioned earlier, we have a hard time to see low-mass stars because they're too far away from us. And up until now, the sensitivity to detect these low-mass stars has been pretty bad. But now we have a great instrument, and that's ALMA. It's a great observatory, and the sensitivity to detect these faint objects is a lot better. Has improved substantially. And I think that is really the main reason that we were able to detect them. just simply because a new instrument has been able to have a much better sensitivity and detecting these very faint objects towards the center of the galaxy. So that is really the main reason. Is just the instrumentation has instrumentation capability of ALMA is just remarkable, and we were lucky basically to look at this first and detecting these low mass stars. So what we are seeing is an indication of the earliest phase of low mass star formation. Generally, a collapse of a cloud takes place, and then eventually this collapse, the disk is formed around the protostar, and then a protostar ejects some of the material in the immediate vicinity. So then you get this sort of what is known as bipolar outflows. Somehow the system tries to clean itself up by having all the material that may be just moving around the formation of star. And what we're seeing is this phase that all low-mass stars have gone through in the past. And it's basically getting rid of some of the material in the vicinity of the protostar. And so that's what we see. We see these bipolar outflows coming from a central protostar. And the reason that we think that these are at the center of the galaxy and very close to the black hole is that the protostar is moving at about 100 kilometers per second. And the motion of the protostar, the central protostar, tells us right away that this cannot be in the direction or somewhere near us, because all low-mass stars that we find in the disk of the galaxy, they usually have a much, much lower velocity as they move around the galaxy. So we know that these features are at the center of the galaxy, and so we saw this surprising result that we see these bipolar outflows. Bipolar outflows generally are generated by having a jet coming from the central protostar, and this jet has some momentum, and this momentum of the jet basically pushes all the gas in the immediate vicinity of the protostar, and we see these beautiful lobes that one side is coming towards us and the other side is moving away from us, and that is why it's called a bipolar outflow or blue shifted and red shifted outflows when viewed from our the angle that we observe the center of the galaxy.
So these are protostars, which means that they're extremely young. I think they're on the order of 6,000 years old. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the estimate, because we can find the velocity of how fast these guys are moving away from the protostar, and we also know the length of these individual bipolar outflows. So we can determine basically the time, how long has this protostar been doing this, sort of pushing away the material, and that gives us an early age of 6,000. This is the earliest phase of star formation that we see in the center of the galaxy, apart from other things like low-mass stars and everything, but this is really, we know that star formation has taken place a few million years ago. These are massive stars that we have a fairly good understanding of their age and how they're formed. But low-mass stars in such an environment and being so young is something that makes it actually quite interesting.
And also so close to the center of the galaxy. I mean, I think they're 3 light years from the galaxy's central black hole. That's even closer than the closest star is to our own solar system. I mean, that's how close we're talking about. It's pretty amazing.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yeah, no, that's surprising, because you would think that tidal effects rip apart the original cloud from which the protostar is formed. But in this case, we have some 11 examples of such bipolar outflows, and it looks like star formation is pretty robust in this region. At least low mass star formation at the earliest phase looks like happening and we are now learning that apart from the fact that you have such tidal effects that tries to rip apart a cloud, but in some ways you can actually tidal effects can also help you. As I mentioned earlier, if you have a cloud approaching towards a black hole, tidal effects can also squeeze the cloud. And that's what you really need in order for a cloud to collapse and form star. You need to have a squeezing of the cloud. And that is one effect that could help in formation of a star. But there are other pathways. We don't necessarily know for sure what is really the best pathway to form a star so close to the black hole within few light years of the black hole, and that's I think a subject of much interest I think in the future, and trying to figure out basically what's the best pathway to form stars so close to a black hole, we're hoping to there are some ideas, and I can tell you a little bit about some what we're thinking. And one of the ideas is that you have some kind of a outflow from the central black hole, and this outflow provides a sufficient pressure, external pressure, to the cloud, and then the cloud collapses under the external pressure. So that's what we're thinking.
So that's really interesting, because that's kind of flipping on its head the assumption that the black hole is actually a hazard and a challenge, having a black hole in your neighborhood as far as getting star formation off the ground. You're turning that on its head. You're saying the black hole may actually be the responsible party for allowing the conditions to lead to star formation.
That's right. It's a sort of paradoxical. And the black hole is not only is trying to rip apart the cloud, but also it does some activities that the activity of the black hole itself, it's an outflow or a jet, and this could also act as a pressure, an external pressure that would help basically the collapse of a cloud forming stars. And so it makes it really interesting that how, when a cloud approaches, it's not clear exactly what the black hole is going to do, whether it's going to sort of tries to rip the cloud apart, or is it going to just make the cloud collapse and form stars. So that's one of the ideas that we have in forming in basically explaining the origin of these stars, these young stars near the black hole. So whatever the mechanism is that produces the collapse of a cloud near a supermassive black hole, it has to be some kind of an external pressure. So generally, we don't think too much about external pressure elsewhere in the galaxy. We usually think about a cloud basically collapses slowly under its own mass, its own weight, essentially, and forms a star. Now, when you're in an environment that has a lot of pressure, external pressure, and this external pressure actually can help. And so even though the cloud is about to be ripped apart by the black hole, but if the external pressure is there, it can actually counteract the tidal effects or counteract the ripping of the cloud by the tidal forces. And I think that's what we think is happening, because this is a new effect. The external pressure provides a strong push that's what the cloud needs in order to basically collapse under its own self-gravity, getting some help from the environment close to the black hole itself.
I know this is an odd comparison, but it's almost like these stars are like extremophile species. Just as we're discovering that life is hardier than we thought, we can find life in these extreme environments on Earth, we're also finding stars in these extreme environments in the galaxy. It's just sort of interesting. I guess it's kind of humbling, and science often does humble us to realize that whether it's life or whether it's star formation, our our predictions based on our own experiences as a particular species on a planet in one solar system isn't necessarily the norm, or at least it isn't the entire story across the galaxy, is it?
That's right. I mean, star formation can happen in different environments. The environment near the sun is a bit different than elsewhere, but star formation is very robust, and I think somehow nature finds a way to do what it wants to do, even in a most extreme environment. And that's what I think we see, and it's certainly a good analogy. The same thing happens also for species under very sort of hostile environment. Somehow they survive. That makes the analogy quite interesting.
So, speaking of life and homes for life in particular, is there any possibility of planets being able to survive around these new 11 stars that your team recently discovered, or any of the other more massive stars that were discovered not too long ago within that region close to the supermassive black hole?
Well, that's one of the implications of these observations, because they are solar type, and the next thing for us is to figure out basically the mass of the disk from which the protostar is formed. And there is a relationship that we need to have. Once we know the mass of the disk around the protostar, then we can say whether the planets can form there. So far, we've done also some other work in the past. It looks like the disk, the mass of the disk that is orbiting about some of these protostars is sufficient for formation of planets. But we need to do more work on it. And so that's what planets are formed around low-mass stars. And we have a very strong indication that we have low-mass protostar. So I think the formation of planets is possible. The issue would be then whether they survive as they orbit around the supermassive black hole. Whether they get ejected or whether they can stay in there is a different question. Certainly, there would be no chance for life there because the radiation is very strong from outside. But planetary formation is certainly one of the things that we are looking and trying to figure out, basically, if there are any planets around these protostars.
I know in the past, or maybe even more recently, you've done some work studying Sagittarius A star itself and looking at the unusual flare activity. And I'm just curious if, just because that's something we haven't really talked about here at the Star Spot before, if you can just kind of explain to me what that flare activity is all about and whether that might make it even more difficult for planets or life to be sustained, to emerge and then to be sustained for long periods of time if they're in a solar system that is so close to that flare activity at the center?
The flare activity happens actually quite often when you look at Sagittarius star, the supermassive black hole. And on a daily sort of flares happen, but these flares are fairly, they have a fairly low intensity. So they're not very strong enough to really affect objects that are even a few light years away. So that's not really the issue. It wouldn't really have any effect as far as the survival of these clouds. So what we think is happening is that these flares generate a blob of gas that is actually moving away from the black hole itself. So they can actually act as an external pressure, but the radiation that comes off from flaring activity of the black hole itself is fairly weak. But it is possible that every few hundred years or maybe a few thousand years or so, you get a big flare that would make it very difficult for life to affecting basically if there was a planet there. So make it much more intense. But flares generally go in some directions. They don't really go everywhere. They're just basically, they're more collimated if they're coming from a disk of the black hole itself. And flaring, again, is an interesting issue. But what we've learned so far from flaring activity of Sagittarius Star is that you get these ejection of material coming off from the black hole itself. These are low, the intensity blobs of gas that are generated as these blobs get ejected from the black hole itself. And I don't think they may not have a really major effect on formation of stars, but in fact, if they are strong enough, these outflows, they can actually induce star formation, as I mentioned earlier. So again, they can help the formation of the planet, the formation of star. But if the intensity of the radiation is very, very high, let's say if it's an X-ray, a powerful X-ray flare is generated, or a gamma ray flare is generated, then obviously it's going to affect there was any form of life in there. It could destroy basically all molecules, so that's something that may probably happen in the long run, not on a daily basis. Daily basis on the daily activity of the black hole itself is the intensity is fairly really weak and faint, and it wouldn't really affect any of the planetary or protostars that we see very close to the black hole.
So in terms of continuing our work to characterize what's happening at the center of the galaxy, what would be next for you and your team?
We are excited to expand the inner region of the galaxy from a few light years, maybe to about 10 light years. There's a very a big reservoir of cloud sitting actually outside the inner few light years. In fact, this is really surprising for us to find these protostars in the vicinity so close to the black hole, because if you move away about 3 light years away, you see this cloud of gas, and they actually should be forming stars a lot easier than inside the sort of a donut shaped cloud that we see. So, but we haven't really observed those clouds yet. So we're hoping to look at this ring of molecular gas that goes around the black hole and just see what's whether this star formation is continuing on even beyond a few light years from the black hole. But in addition, we are trying to figure out the possibility of formation of planetary systems around these low mass stars, and that's something that we can do: measure the mass of the disk around the protostars, and that tells us right away whether there is sufficient mass for formation of planets around these protostars, and that's really two things that we're thinking of doing: expanding a little bit the area that we covered, and at the same time trying to learn more about the possibility of planetary formation around these protostars very close to the black hole.
Professor Farhad Yousafzadeh, I want to thank you so much for joining us here at the Star Spot and sharing the news of this very remarkable discovery. And congratulations to you and your team.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot. Mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com.
The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li. Marketing and promotions by Natalie Morcos. Guest hosting by Denise Fong. News production by Benjamin Jenkins.
News contributions from Julia Mazurchuk, Mallory Warren, Jessica Campbell, and Victoria Duncan. Web design by Blair Renault, graphics by Carmina Svillens. And I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening.